appreciate it. So the topic I chose for tonight, I wrote this down, is taking refuge where practice begins. Every night when we come here, we hear this group and any other Theravada group and many other Buddhist groups, the first thing you always do is you chant the three refuges. It's a deep tradition. And what I want to do tonight is talk about, well, what does that mean? I mean, why just three refuges? Why those three? What's the significance of them? What's the meaning of these things? Just sort of let us dig a little deeper into how we start. And I want to start by actually looking at the word refuge. I mean, what does, when we say we're taking refuge, well, if you look in the dictionary, which I did, the dictionary defines a refuge as a shelter or protection from danger, trouble, etc. A place of shelter, protection, or safety. So in taking refuge, we are either physically or mentally, emotionally, going to a place that we feel safe, where we can and feel that it's okay to connect with deeper things and not have to be in that protective mode we often have to be out there in the world, or at least we feel we have to be out there in the world. And so that's the actual meaning. So by chanting the refuge chant, we are literally creating for ourselves a practice container, a place of refuge, a space where we feel safe. So why do we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha? So when we say we take refuge in the Buddha, that could mean several things. You know, if we were born in a Theravadan country or in a Buddhist country, it would mean something to us because it would be part of our culture. We would have, you know, a Buddha in our house, and it'd be Buddhas, you know, like everywhere we went. It would be, Buddha would be part of our cultural understanding. And so taking refuge in the Buddha could mean taking refuge in that cultural understanding. But most of us here, I suspect, weren't born in Buddhist countries. You know, Buddhism isn't that, doesn't have that long a history. Though maybe in Boulder some of you are second generation Buddhists. But outside of Boulder, there's probably not too many places you could say that. I know a few people of that ilk. So if it's not this cultural understanding, what else could it mean? Well, it could mean this: we take refuge in the understanding that this person called the Buddha, you know, almost 2,600 years ago, was here on the earth. He became enlightened and he taught for 40 years. And so we could be taking refuge, in a sense, in that historical figure, that person who changed the world in a pretty remarkable way and continues to do so in various ways, I suppose you could say. And so we could take, so in that sense, we're taking refuge in the fact that there was this enlightened being, that someone actually reached enlightenment and then taught us and his followers and his followers and his followers and so on through all those years, taught us what he knew so we could reach enlightenment as well. I find that comforting, that someone actually did it. And the third meaning, however, could mean that we're taking refuge in what I'll call our Buddha nature. It's not just the Buddha who can be enlightened, but there's within all of us this capability. And the interesting thing is, the Buddha wasn't so sure about that at the start. After he became enlightened, he had this sort of big internal debate about, well, what do I do now? You know, he's in his 30s. He's got a long, fairly long life ahead of him. What do I do now? And I'm actually going to read you a little bit from something called the Aryaparya Yasnana Sutta. Please don't correct my Pali. This is from this book called The Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha, and it's actually describing Buddha's, in this sutta, he's describing what happened after he became enlightened, what he was sort of going through. And he's, you know, talking to a bunch of disciples. And this is so the Buddha is saying, I considered, this Dhamma that I've attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. Sounds like our generation. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. It is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Thereupon, and so he's like, why would I can't teach this to anybody. It's basically what he's like, how could I possibly teach this? No one's going to understand what I say. And he'd spent a long time before his enlightenment living in the forest as a sadhu, and he was like thinking, well, maybe I'll just go back and I'll sit in the forest for the rest of my life and enjoy this enlightenment that I've achieved. And then in the next verse is this. Then Bhikkhus, the Brahma, Shamapati, knew with his mind the thought in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, inclines to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. So this celestial being tuned into the Buddha's mind and said, uh-oh, we're in trouble. This guy, he's not going to teach. And what happens is he takes a physical form and he says, all right. He says, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. They are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who understand the Dhamma. And the Buddha paid attention. He said, okay, I guess I... And so he decided, okay, I am going to go teach. And that's pretty amazing when you think about it. Here's this person who was just like totally happy. And then he said, okay, now for the rest of my life, I'm going to teach. So that other people, those with little dust in their eyes, which I think is a great image. You know, if you have just a little dust in your eyes and it gets cleared away somehow, then you see clearly, which is what the Buddha did. He saw clearly. So it's a great sort of image. Anyhow, so you can, in the sense, taking refuge in the fact that he decided to actually teach us. And then, you know, the Pali Canon, which is a, you know, bookshelf this big full of books, which is just a little part of, comes into being. It's like the roadmap, which is the second thing we take refuge in, of course. That is, I forgot one thing here. So, but the thing about all these ways of taking refuge in the Buddha, you know, in the historical figure, in the cultural figure, in the fact that he said, yeah, other people can actually understand this and reach enlightenment as well. Taking refuge in that is an act of faith. Faith isn't a word we hear a lot in the Buddhist world, but I think it's very apropos here. We can't know for sure. We actually have to take a leap of faith that this man existed, that he was enlightened, and what he taught leads us to enlightenment. That's an act of pure faith. So taking refuge in the Buddha is an act of faith. Then there's the Dhamma. The Dhamma means typically the teachings of the Buddha. So to take refuge in the Dhamma which is like a detailed map, a way, a means to enlightenment. To take refuge in the Dhamma is an act of effort. I mean, the Dhamma's there, but it's like this book is dense. And there's many books like this. And then there's people, you know, interpretations of it, and other people wrote about it. But to take refuge in the Dhamma, you have to study the Dhamma. It's as simple as that. You can't just sort of, oh, isn't it nice the Dhamma's there? This big pile of interesting stuff. You know, part of taking refuge in the Dhamma is just listening to Dhamma talks. It's a wonderful way. Some people don't like to read, aren't big readers. I'm a big reader, always have been. But you know, we have that nice bin of thousands of Dhamma talks, hundreds of Dhamma talks right there. Wonderful way to take refuge in the Dhamma is to actually study it, to understand it. This takes effort. It has to be something you do as opposed to something you think you might do someday. You have to actually do something to take refuge in the Dhamma. Then there's the Sangha. Sangha traditionally means all those people who have become enlightened since the Buddha became enlightened by following his teachings. And I want to read another little section of this same sutta. So basically what happened is, so the Buddha decided, okay, now I have to go teach. Now what do I do? Who am I going to go teach? And at first he thought, oh, because earlier in his life, 6 or 7 years before this point, he'd studied with two great masters of the time. And had gotten very deeply into concentration practice and other traditions of practice, but at a certain point had realized work. And he left these teachers much to their disappointment, because they both these teachers had taken him on as a co-teacher. And then he finally said, sorry, I gotta go, this isn't working, I gotta go do something else. So I know, I'll go teach those guys. Because they just had a little bit of dust. If they'd just seen this one other little thing I saw, the dust would fall from their eyes and they'd be enlightened. But intuitively, it came to him that they both died within the last week. They both just passed away. So he couldn't go teach them. So then he said, oh, I know. There's these guys he used to hang out with in the forest. There's five bhikkhus he used to hang out with in the forest. I'll go teach them. They're usually out at some place, you know, a couple of weeks' walk from here. So I'll just walk there and I'll teach them, because they were pretty close to him. So I'll teach them. And he walks and he walks and he comes to where these guys are, these five. And these were bhikkhus who practice austerity. So, I mean, their whole belief was, if you just suffer enough, you'll understand suffering. You know, so they were like really emaciated and dirty, and the Buddha by this point had sort of left them, and had sort of got a little flesh on his cheeks and was clean and wore clean robes and was sort of pretty okay looking. And they saw him coming, and it was like they had this little discussion. Oh, there's that backslider, Gautama. We'll acknowledge his presence, but we won't give him any term of honor when we speak to him. And then as he gets closer and closer, it's like, there's something different about this guy. You know, they sort of tune into the fact, and he says, they ask him what's going on. He says, you know, I no longer suffer. I'm enlightened. Not in more words than that, but that's basically what and they sort of looked at him and scoffed a little bit, but then he said it 2 or 3 times, and it was like, they could see there was something different. They said, well, teach us. And so that was the first time he taught, and he taught the Four Noble Truths, of course. That was the first teaching he gave. And at the end of that teaching, here's these five bhikkhus, and this is what it says here. Then the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, dhamma, attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. All they had to do was hear the teachings once, and the dust fell from their eyes. And they were the first members of the Sangha. And then, who knows how many thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the last 20, almost 2,600 years have joined that group of people who have become enlightened by hearing the Dhamma and studying the Dhamma and practicing the Dhamma. And I find this encouraging because it's not just the Buddha who did this. This is actually, here's these, and actually throughout the sutta, there's just like hundreds of men and women who, monks and nuns who became enlightened during the lifetime of the Buddha. Hundreds of people who became enlightened. So it's like, you can actually do this. This is like, these were like regular people. Like they were like housewives and tailors, and one was a horrible famous murderer and thief. All these people became enlightened. Okay. Gives me sort of encouragement. I can take refuge in the fact that, other people can do this too, not just the Buddha. So that's one way of thinking about the Sangha. The other way there's two other ways. One is think of all the people in the world as you sit and take refuge. Think of all the other people in the world right now, right at this instant, who are studying the Dhamma, practicing the Dhamma, teaching the Dhamma, sitting, walking, doing whatever practices they do. There's so many of them. Thousands and thousands and thousands. Every time they do a census in the United States, the number of Buddhists goes up. It's a good sign. But it's comforting that this is not just me. It's not just us in this room. Everywhere. Yeah. And then the last meeting of the Dhamma, and the one that for me is the most comforting personally, is the Sangha is the people who right now you're practicing with. These people sitting right here, right now, or the people I practice with on a regular basis. Every Tuesday night we all come here and we sit and we practice and then we hear Dhamma talk and we have discussion. That's Sangha. Sangha is personal. Sangha, if taking refuge in the Buddha is an act of faith, and taking refuge in the Dhamma is an act of effort, of study, of effort, taking refuge in the Sangha is an act of love. It's pure and simple that. It's that feeling we develop for each other over time as we practice together. Over long, it's like people here, I don't even know half of your names, or most of your names probably. But there's people like, he's here again tonight. Isn't that great? And I feel happy just to see those people there. If you do long sitting periods like I do, there'll be people sitting in the hall. Like I'll be sitting, there'll be someone sitting, say, there. So all I know, I don't know their name, don't know anything about them. All I know is the back of their head. But by the end of a month or 6 weeks, it's like, there's something about that person just sitting there that is just so special. Because they've been part of my Sangha, this intense practice period, and they just become special people. And then they go and I may never see them again. But that's okay, because I know they're practicing. They're still out there in that global practice community. So that's taking refuge in the Sangha. And it's important that all three of these things, well, I remember I said, why three and why these three? Well, I think it's interesting if you look at what happens when one of those three, faith, effort, and love, aren't there. What do you get if only two of those three are there? For instance, what if we have faith and we make effort to study the teachings, but we don't have that love for all beings? What happens? Fanaticism, fundamentalism, extremism. People who say, my way is the right way, and can quote you chapter and verse from whatever particular holy book they're using, whether it's the Pali Canon, or the Bible, or the Quran, or the Bhagavad Gita, doesn't make any difference. Those people of all those religions and groups that do exactly what I'm talking about, you end up with this, this is where terrorism arises in the world, from exactly this place. People have knowledge, they have faith, but they've lost connection to their heart. And they act out of this totally mental space with no heart connection. So that's what happens, I think, if you don't get all, if you have faith and effort. If you have faith and love, but you don't have effort, you get about half the population of Boulder, probably. Among other things. You know, it's like, oh, God is love, I'm love, everything's love, all I need is love. You know, it's like a Beatles song or something. You know? It's not grounded in understanding. And it's kind of sweet. I mean, I was a hippie. I know what this is like. Believe me, you know, it's like, this is what the whole hippie thing was. It was like, you know, it's all, everything was love and everything's good, man, you know, through a haze of smoke. We used to say that to each other, you know. And it's like, it's just so ungrounded. I mean, you get beautiful things like Woodstock. And then the next year you get Altamont, which is the opposite of Woodstock, for those of you, maybe I'm using cultural references you don't know. Woodstock, everybody knows what Woodstock is, right? Okay. Altamont was the next year. There's a huge concert in California where the Rolling Stones hired the Hell's Angels to be the security. And people got murdered and beaten to death with pool cues. This is the opposite of Woodstock. But it was coming from that thing. It was like, because it wasn't, the understanding just wasn't grounded in knowledge, in study. And no one had put the effort into actually understanding the teachings. They spouted them, me included. And so it's not balanced. There's no dark side. You know, there's the 10,000 joys with no 10,000 sorrows. Sorry, that isn't the way things work. You know, there's got to be this balance that people who have faith and are filled with love but don't have the understanding that underpins true knowledge fall into this excess of sucrose sweetness. I thought of something. Richard Freeman, who I've studied with on and off for years, has this great saying. It says, too many sucrose thoughts cause truth decay. So, Richard is full of little gems like that, so. So what happens if you have knowledge and love, but no faith? Well, that's probably a lot of the other part of Boulder that wasn't in that first half. But basically, you get what Trungpa Rinpoche called spiritual materialism. You get people who, oh, Monday night I'll go to Sufi dancing, and Tuesday night I'll go to David's group, and Wednesday night I'll, you know. And in Boulder, you could do a different thing every night of the week for a month and never go to the same group twice, right? And they're all interesting and fascinating, but you never get grounded once again. You're just dabbling because there's no faith. What faith does is grounds you in a particular teaching or a particular lineage or a particular form of practice. That's what faith gives you. You have faith in the teachings, therefore you have faith in the teacher and the teachings, therefore you've practiced in this certain way. And then you stick with it. There's an old Indian adage, if you want water, you don't dig 10 one-foot wells, you dig one 10-foot well. You have to go deep, whatever practice it is, whether it's this practice or some other practice, you have to go deep, deep, deep into the practice. I heard Joseph Goldstein say something really interesting about this the last time I sat with him. He said, you have to pick a practice and just go way deep into it. And then after about 10 years, it's okay to maybe look at other things. Because you'll understand after 10 years, you'll have some understanding of the practice, some true understanding of the practice you're actually doing. And that'll give you a basis to be able to compare with some knowledge and understanding when you encounter other practices. But you need about 10 years. That's a lot of practice time. Before you start dabbling, looking at other things. And then you can have a valid place to compare from. Otherwise, you're like, it's like you get this maze of different ideas. You know, even if like if you go to different forms of Buddhist practice, you think, well, they're all Buddhism, right? No, unfortunately, that's not true. I mean, there are distinct similarities, but there's also really important and very significant differences in the form of the practice and in the teachings themselves. So it's good to find something that suits you, that suits your nature. Lucky me, I found one. And then stick with it for a long time. So those are the three. What happens if we're missing one? If we're missing two, I don't even want to go there. It gets really messy after. But we really need all three. We need faith, we need effort, and we need love. Those three all. And if you look at lots of other religions and teachings, will have those things expressed in different ways. Now abideth faith, hope, and love. These three. You know, 2 Corinthians. I mean, you see this in other traditions and other places. This isn't unique to Buddhism. I want to make any claims in that sense. It's just, it's so deeply embedded in Buddhist practice. It's the first thing we do. We sit, we chant the refuges. Any long retreat I've ever been on, the first thing we do is we chant the refuges. Anytime I've come here, the first thing we do is chant the refuges. Every time I teach, myself, the first thing I do is we chant the refuges. It's like deeply embedded in us as a way of making that connection. But there's one other thing that's necessary besides all of this, what is so far as I'll call knowledge. And that is we have to actually feel something. You know, refuge isn't an idea. It's an experience. We have to actually experience what it means to be in refuge. And I'm going to start this part of my talk by reading you something. This is a wonderful book called Go In and In by Dana Faulds, if you're poetry fans. And this is called Lay the Armor Down. Arriving back from the fields of battle, bruised and bolder, we are beholden to no one now. Losing or winning, the reasons for war fade quickly in the memory. We've forgotten that these suits of armor are not our second skins. Smiling, we set aside the shields and swords, remove the face mask, peel away the layers of weight and protection. When finally we cast our armor to the ground, it feels as if our bodies grow and straighten, swell and lengthen upwards toward the sun. We run, light and unencumbered, and stretch the stiffness from our joints. Rolling on the grass, we laugh as awkward limbs remember freedom. When at last we return to where we started, without a second glance, we know that we've outgrown the suits of armor. We won't fit inside these two tight shells again. Why would we even try? That's what it means to be in refuge. To take your armor off and grow so it won't fit anymore. It's a wonderful image, I think. Just that becomes more permanent. It's like we don't need that armoring we wear all the time. That psychological, mental armor that we put on as we go out our front door, or maybe as we get out of bed in the morning even. So I had a very personal experience of this myself. My very first sit, my first month-long sit at Spirit Rock, I'd sat three 10-day sits before this, so I sort of thought I knew what I was getting into, foolishly. And so I was about 8 or 9 days into this month-long sit. And I was like, oh my God, it's not, it's like, you know, it's like, oh my God, it's like, there's still so much time left. And Spirit Rock's in the Marin Hills, and it's sort of at the base of these hills, the actual sitting hall, and there's these hills that are quite steep, and there's these nice sort of zigzag paths you can take. I was having none of those zigzag paths. I was like climbing straight up the walls. It's like, get me out of here, sort of feeling, you know. And I was deep in the midst of what is called an MKA, a multiple kilesa attack. You know, I was full of doubt. Doubt that I could do the practice, doubt of the teachers, doubt of the teaching. I was restless. I was grumpy. I was like, just like, you know, I didn't like how they organized things. You know, I had this saying, I was, you know, I wouldn't let these people organize a cat fight. I mean, it was like, just like everything was negative, negative, negative. It was like, it was incredible. And, but at the same time, all this is going on in my fevered mind. There's this beautiful chant they do, or they were doing every night at the end of the practice called the sharing of blessings and aspirations. And the last verse of that is an actual restatement of the refuges. And I'd been, because even though I was going crazy, I'm a very disciplined kind of guy. I mean, military family, you know. I was memorizing this whole chant. And I was working on, at this point, this particular day, on the last verse, this verse that was a restating of the three refuges. And I was basically, everywhere I went, I was sort of chanting this over and over again in my head. You know, walking to breakfast, chanting it, going for a walk. And so, basically, this is what I was chanting. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. So I have these two different currents running at the same time. This multiple kilesa attack, and then just chanting this over and over again in my mind. And then I went to one of the morning sits. I went to sit, and it's like, oh, I'm sitting, right? So I'm supposed to be like paying attention to the breath and, you know, doing vipassana and noting and all these things I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like really sort of tense and wound up and trying to just do what I'm supposed to be doing, right, which is the practice. And I'd be sitting there, and I'd be like, you know, in, out, in, the Buddha. And then I'd just, there would be that verse again, because I'd been practicing so much there, so I'd just be chanting this verse over and over again. And then, no, I'm not supposed to be doing that, you know, and I'm going, no, I'm going to sit here, and you know, I'm going to be serious, you know. And then it hit me that what this chant was saying was really true. That I was really in this incredibly safe refuge. That I was being taught the Dhamma, that I was practicing, that I was studying, that I was surrounded by people who really cared. And I just melted down. I just wept. I just sat in my chair there and just wept for like, I don't know, a long time. And I know, oh, then it's like, it was like, I just sort of let go to the fact that I was in refuge. I actually experienced what that meant. It was like, wow, this is amazing. It was a different, it was a very different feeling than I'd ever had before. I'd never taken off my armor before. I'd never really let that go and just open to what was there. And you know, I think back about all those tears, because then I got up out of the sit, and it's supposed to be a walking period, and I'm like, a basket case. My mother's voice comes in my head, what you need is a good cup of tea. So I go off and I make myself a strong cup of tea, and I drink my tea, and I go back and I sit, and I'm crying. It's like all day long. It's like I'm weeping most of the day, probably. And all the time I think, well, when I thought later about these tears, it's either were these tears of relief, like, whew, I finally figured this out, or were they tears of joy? Like, isn't this wonderful? And probably some of both. Probably some of both. But that's what has to happen. You have to let go into this practice. You have to let this practice take over your heart as well as your mind. It has to be both. They're not really separate anyway. We just think they are. And it's heart-mind, right? In the Buddhist tradition. Now, there's one other thing I want to mention. I didn't have dust in my eyes. I think I had mud in my eyes. Okay, I mean, I was a slow starter, right? But it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, right here, right now, in this room, you know, I look around, and what I see, just see Buddha nature shining at me out of all those eyes, all those beautiful eyes. It's just full of Buddha nature. And here we are, we're studying the Dhamma together. That's what we're doing. And, you know, David's created this incredible practice container for us to practice in. And out of that container, Sangha has arisen. You know, and David wouldn't claim any responsibility for that, I don't think. He's set up the causes and conditions that might happen. But it happens because you're all here. Sangha is us. You are the reason there is Sangha here every week. And all during the week when you're not in this chair or on the floor. This is where Sangha is created, and it's all here right now. All you got to do is take off your armor. It's right here for all of us, all the time, free of charge. Just take it. There's one other poem I want to read here. This poem, surprisingly, is called Sangha. Teach me what I cannot learn alone. Let us share what we know and what we cannot fathom. Speak to me of mysteries, and let us never lie to one another. May our fierce and tender longing fuel the fires in our souls. When we stand side by side, let us dare to focus our desires on the truth. May we be reminders, each for the other, that the path of transformation passes through the flames. To take one step is courageous. To stay on the path day after day, choosing the unknown and facing yet another fear, that is nothing short of grace. I love poetry, so. So that's all I have to say. But I sort of intentionally have a big chunk of time here for people to share their experiences of taking refuge, to ask questions, and I'll try and give intelligent answers, or just this, whatever seems appropriate. Please let me know how you feel, what you're thinking. Jay's got a microphone, as usual, to hand around to people. So just go ahead. Questions, thoughts, emotions, events, memories, dreams, reflections. I stunned you all so much you can't speak.
Did you read that whole book?
But this whole book? I'm actually that's my study project for the next 6 months. I finished Sutta 34 of 150 today. So I'll finish sometime in the summer. But yeah, I plan to read the whole book. I have a study period every morning. So yeah. I'm pretty crazy.
Barry, I just really wanted to send great thanks of you sharing that experience to the group. And I think when you're in retreat or even in these experiences that we have, even on Tuesday nights, just to be able to share that on a step-by-step, you know, from a period of confusion and doubt, and then this transformation of understanding and insight. And it's the step-by-step that is the whole part. And I love witnessing that, because so much, we speak of so much of the enlightenment and the awakening and the unfolding that's this grandiose view, but it's really this sense of confusion and doubt also that's the whole piece of it. And just to hear that is, it's amazing to, you know, to witness that. It just really sets my heart in a tender space. So thank you, Barry, for sharing that.
Okay. Enlightenment is a moment-by-moment experience that at some point shifts into something else. And we all have, everyone in this room has moments of insight all the time. And it's just we either don't notice them or we don't think they're important. We sort of, that couldn't be that important, you know. But all those moments, if you actually take them in, that's a moment of enlightenment that just occurred, just now. And then there's another one, and there's another one. And they add, they sort of grow and grow, and then you have these sort of moments like I described, you know, where like the avalanche hits you as opposed to like a little drop of water. But they're equally valuable. Sometimes it's those little moments that you, oh, that sort of shift things for you quite dramatically, as much as the dramatic ones. You don't need drama. Please, I know I've had enough drama sometimes. Other people. Everybody wants to go home early tonight. Oh, there's someone over here, Jen.
Thank you so much for this talk. I've come back maybe after a month and a half. I wasn't traveling, so I missed this Sangha very much. And it was just that same feeling, you know, first 10 minutes the day and then sinking into, you know. So we are fairly new here, and it still feels home. What I wanted to talk about, though, was you talked about this suspension of belief, so to speak, right? Because, you know, we've been practicing for 13, 14 years. And I remember in my early days, this was like really total suspension of disbelief. And it's like, you truly believe what the teacher says. You truly believe the path. This is the best path, or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to see how you would address this issue of, you know, teachers are human beings. So I'm not being critical, but I'm just saying, you know, there is this when so I come from Zen tradition, and mm-hmm. you know there have been stories of teachers misbehaving in terrible ways.
Pick a tradition, you'll have those stories.
Right. So, yeah, it's happened with best of teachers in many traditions. So there is this shadow. There is no complete enlightenment, so to speak. And then it's dangerous to be completely surrendering. In some ways, the surrender, this sense of shedding my armor is necessary. And on the other hand, you do need discrimination.
Yeah.
I hope my question makes sense.
No, no, I understand what you're saying. And first of all, very important, don't believe a word I said. Seriously, don't believe a word I said. If the only way to really understand is to experience it yourself. So just because I said it, you know, don't go say, well, Barry said, you know. That's just, you know, that doesn't work. And in this tradition, in the Theravadin tradition that I've been studying in for 10 years, all of my teachers say that to me all the time. Don't believe it unless you've experienced it yourself. So there isn't this worshipful attitude towards teachers, which is, I was in an Indian Hindu tradition for 25 years, where that was very much the case. In the end, I took to this practice, I won't say exclusively because of that, but that was one of the big reasons, is that I was always uncomfortable with that aspect of those traditions. And this tradition is very, very clear that the teacher is not to be worshipped at all. There's this concept called Kalyana Mitra, spiritual friend. And the teacher is your spiritual friend. When I go and study with Guy, it's like there's a closeness, a friendship there, a real genuine friendship. But it's quite clear to me that he knows more than I do. And so I go and study with him because he can teach me things that I just can't learn any other way. So I need a teacher, but I don't need to bow down to him. And he certainly, if I tried to bow down to him, would be very upset with me. So that's why I find this particular tradition so comforting, is that that part of the Eastern world isn't part of this tradition at all. It's not in the Theravada tradition in general and in how that tradition has come to the West, very specifically. It just doesn't exist. You know, you go study with Joseph Goldstein, which I've done. You know, he'll teach, but he'll teach with four other people. The last time I taught, I sat with him, he was teaching his 38th three-month-long retreat. And there was someone there who was teaching his first. And they taught equally. No, like, oh, I'm Joseph, I should do more, I get better times. It was just like Joseph did his thing, and then Greg did his stuff. Equally wonderful teachers, equal amount of time. No special, like, yeah, I'm special, I do more, I get better. It was just like everyone's equal. All the teachers are equal. And they always teach as a team, so you don't get into that space of just one teacher. Yeah. So even though I say my teacher, I say my principal teacher is Guy Armstrong, but I study with other people as well and have learned a great deal from these other teachers I sit with as well. So does that answer your question? That's how I've dealt with it anyway. I've gone away from that bowing down tradition of that you see in many other practices. It just didn't feel comfortable for me. That's just me, and that's after bowing down for 25 years to someone. So it took me a while to figure it out. You know? Okay, other people.
I want to thank you particularly for what you said about Sangha and your definition of it and your explanation of it and that beautiful poem. And I would really like to hear it again and wonder if there's a way that you could share it either on the website or emailing it or what, because I think it just really sums up the nature of Sangha and especially our Sangha. Mm-hmm. It just felt really close and personal to me, so I want to thank you for that.
I will
ask you for more.
Make copies of it and bring them next week. I'll be happy to do that. Now I have to remember I said that, but that's a senior moment and I'll never remember. But other people, we still have a few minutes. Don't be shy. Those people in the back who never say anything. I know why you sit in the back, because then you don't, then no one hide out back there.
Okay.
Oh, the guy with the mic who never said, okay, perfect.
This actually dovetailed nicely with something I've been doing. I guess I began paying attention to the refuges over the last month or so, and I really noticed the way we phrase it in our opening chant, where we take refuge in the Dharma, the teachings that awaken us to reality as it is. And one day it struck me, because I have a background in science and I'm enamored with modern science, I thought, isn't that a description of what modern science is doing piece by piece, is filling in, you know, and awakening us to reality as it is? And a lot of people are resisting much of what we're learning. And yet the world is in trouble because of the lack of some of that knowledge. So I found myself pondering sometimes after our chant, how far does the Dharma stretch? Mm-hmm. And how big is that umbrella? And when we chant that, do we mean just our piece of teachings about reality as it is? Or is there something incumbent upon us to look at things that are sometimes not in our normal range? And the Dalai Lama has been a wonderful example of studying with Western scientists and seeing the connections with Buddhism. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I think it's really great that Western scientists are discovering what the Buddha said 2,600 years ago is true. I think, and I've been part of some of those experiments, though, in a small extent. And it's interesting, you know, like you have all these questionnaires and you fill them out, and then you fill them out again after sitting for a month, and they compare the results somehow. That was the extent of my involvement. But I think it's really good, because I think it brings people to the Dhamma who wouldn't ordinarily be attracted, because they start to see the, quote, scientific proof that what the Buddha taught and understood 2,600 years ago, that there is no separation, that everything is all one, that we're all connected together, is true. So hooray for the scientists, as far as I'm concerned. I think it's really useful and valuable work that they're doing. There seems to be more and more of it all the time, too, from what I can understand. I sort of keep catching little tidbits here and there when I'm reading in journals and things. Oh, here's another person who is doing this. I have a friend who's doing the same thing. Who's just finishing her PhD thesis along those lines, for instance. Just yet another person who's looking at this stuff. So I think it's good. And the other thing is, I think that Dhamma encompasses everything, so including science and everything else. The Dhamma isn't like some little subset of everything. It's everything, and then everything fits in somehow. It's my somewhat biased, perhaps, point of view of the Dhamma. Okay, at this point, unless someone's got a very quick thing, we should just close. So we'll close, since, well, it was a great idea to read that poem again. So I'll read that poem again, and then we'll do a very brief closing. Oops, there it is. This, by the way, is written by a woman who's a yoga teacher and a yogi, not a Buddhist. She's from Kripalu. She has three or four wonderful, wonderful poetry books, if you're interested. Teach me what I cannot learn alone. Let us share what we know and what we cannot fathom. Speak to me of mysteries, and let us never lie to one another. May our fierce and tender longing fuel the fires in our souls. When we stand side by side, let us dare to focus our desire on the truth. May we be reminders, each for the other, that the path of transformation passes through the flames. To take one step is courageous. To stay on the path day after day, choosing the unknown, and facing yet another fear, that is nothing short of grace. So let's just dedicate the merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you for coming and sharing this.
Been using